What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Extreme Drummers Podcast, episode 3. As always, first and foremost, thanks to everybody who's listening. And I hope you're enjoying it. This is really good fun for me, so I hope you're enjoying it as much as I am. And yeah, keep posted in all the normal places. Instagram at Extreme Drummers Podcast or at Downwinding Drum, Facebook Downwinding Drum, YouTube search Extreme Drummers Podcast or extremedrummerspodcast.com. And keep updated because we've got a lot more cool stuff coming. Before we move on to the episode today, obviously sad news this last week with LG from Entombed passing away. So that really sucks, man. I had the pleasure of meeting that dude a whole bunch of times, and he was a really, really lovely guy, really good fun, and obviously a legendary front man and vocalist. And yeah, so everybody make sure you listen to some Entombed this week for that dude. Yeah, RIP, LG, you're a legend. Also, another shout out that I haven't done yet, which is ridiculous. I was meant to do it in the first episode, but I completely forgot because I'm an idiot. So I want to shout out to my dude, Eric, who did the amazing logo and artwork that you've seen all over the place. Big shout out to you, dude. Thank you so much. You made this whole thing come alive, which is wicked. If anybody's interested in his artwork, which is sick, you can get in touch with him on Instagram and Facebook. He's Eric Malamuerte. I think I'm saying that right. And his last name is spelled Malamuerte. Awesome artist. And yeah, thanks so much, dude. I'm sorry it's taken so long to thank you and give you a shout out. But yeah. Right, so episode 3. Alan Cassidy from the Black Dahlia Murder. Legendary dude. Hilarious dude. Incredible drummer, obviously. Me and Alan met back in, I think it was 2014, when Carcass and Black Dahlia toured together. And yeah, watching this guy every night is pretty special. This is a great chat. We get really in-depth on a bunch of stuff. Practice, drummers we like, gear. We talk about nerdy gear stuff. We talk about the stresses of writing and recording albums and but it's a really good fun episode. It's just wicked. I really hope you enjoy it. This was the first episode I ever did where I was recording Zoom audio. So hopefully it sounds all right. I hope you all enjoy it. And I've tried to make it sound as good as I can. So again, thank you so much. Thank you for keeping in touch and keeping up to date with all this stuff. And I hope you enjoy this one and plenty more coming soon. Thanks so much, Alan Cassidy. Let's go. Yeah, how are you, man? Thank you so much for agreeing, and thank you for making it happen, and sorry about the messing around and all that shit.
But man. I've been good, and thanks for having me on. These little things are the only things happening right now that make me feel like I'm still a musician in a band.
Oh, dude, tell me about it. It's partly the reason I started this whole thing was so that I could talk to people that I'd normally see, you know, on the normal kind of circuit that we all do, and just again feel connected to the music industry, which I don't think any of us feel connected to anything right now, do we really?
Yeah, it's very strange. It feels like this purgatory almost that we're in, where it's like we know that there's still something out there, but it's just, you know, when are we going to get back to it, and what's it going to be like?
Exactly. It's like this carrot just being dangled in front of your face, just like, oh, maybe, oh no, no, one step back, and then two, oh no, and then another step back, and then
yeah. Exactly. So it's been very interesting. I mean, it's been, I think, revealing to just see, you know, what else you're kind of capable of or what you want to do when you're kind of just forced to do anything else, you know? I mean, like,
yeah,
absolutely. I've tried to keep drums in the forefront, but as far as you know, like money making goes, and I don't know, just getting a chance to kind of like have time to do other things, it's been interesting to, you know, get that opportunity, because man, I don't know about you, but I haven't had like a whole lot of time off consistently in the last like decade, you know? So
yeah, dude, I was gonna say, like, I realized, well, quite early on into all this, that I hadn't spent this much time at home since I was like 17. Like 18. You're probably the same, right?
yeah it was about 19 that I started like touring, and then I think yeah. about like 2021 was when I really started getting consistently serious with it.
Yeah. But yeah, so like what do your days look like these days? What's a day in the life of Alan at the moment? Like, is it, while, I guess, aside from touring, obviously there's no touring, but like, is your daily life at home different to when you had like your daily life off of tour? Is it similar, or is it completely different now?
Oh no, I'm still living tour life. I sit around, I don't shower, I move when I have to. You know, I'm trying to live as much in that lifestyle as possible still. But I'm
you're preserving the lifestyle until you go back.
That's right, and the smell. Just really letting it ferment and reminding everyone what they missed out on. I sometimes sit around in just my sweaty drum shorts for a few days, you know, just so I can feel some semblance of normalcy again. But I have just been I've been dog dadding because this little guy, he's still got some training to do, and he's like extra smart. Like, he can pick up on stuff so fast. You show him something like two or three times and like, oh, I don't know if you heard that, but he's like super vocal.
Yeah, what was
too.
That?
He's just like, he does these stretches and he's like, oh, he has like these disappointed and like frustrated growls that he does. And oh my God, one day it cracked me up so hard. Like, anytime you're standing up and you're not paying
that
attention,
sounded like a cat.
he just like wants to yell at you for not either paying attention to him or acknowledging him or, you know, doing something with him and stuff. And one day it was just so good. He was like, I had just gotten home from someplace, and out of nowhere, he just goes, and like, I couldn't believe that it was my dog. I was just like, that is the most demanding, frustrated sounding growl I've ever heard. It sounded like a human child or something. And so he's hilarious. He's a total character. And then I've been working on the commission work that I took on for a while now. And I'm sorry to everybody that I haven't gotten around to finishing your stuff yet. It was just like, it was such a whirlwind when I took it on. It was like, you know, 2 weeks afterwards or whatever, Dahlia decided to do our Christmas special that we did. And then I ended up getting COVID right after that.
What?
And
you got COVID. Shit.
Yeah. I got it, and it really sucked,
it?
Man.
It was, oh man, no way.
It was manageable, but you know, being sick regardless sucks. I just didn't get it nearly as bad as some other people have. And it was like strange as well, because it hit me within like 12 hours. I was just progressively feeling worse by the hour, and then finally by about like 6 p.m. or something, I was just, you know, I could feel the fevers and the chills and everything. And
oh man.
And it wasn't until like probably 4 or 5 days after I had gotten it that I really like actually started losing my smell and taste, which was strange.
So you did lose all that stuff too. So you got like the traditional symptoms.
Yeah. And it was, you know, it was kind of weird because it just started out as like a cold and flu type of feeling. And and then the weirdest part was that I was only one of maybe half our group or less than half our group that got COVID afterwards, and everyone else managed to escape it somehow.
Wow. Fucking hell. I mean, that kind of sums up how the whole thing's gone though, right? Like, some people just don't get it. Some people get it, don't even know. Some people get it really bad. Some people get it mild. So it's just like, you just can't predict what the fuck's happening at any point.
And I just tell people, just go get tested though if you get sick, period, because there's so many people who just want to be like, well, I think all I've got is a cold, or all I've got is this, and all I've got is allergies. And it's like, dude, more than likely, if you're feeling anything at this moment with everything considered, you're probably sick. Like, you should probably get double checked.
How hard is it to just, you know, to just quickly check and make sure? It's really not that hard, I guess, these days.
Yeah, especially if it's free. Like, just, you know,
exactly.
Go to the clinic.
Exactly. And what is the commission thing? Is that the thing that you said about where you're programming other people's drums and like writing drum parts for other people? Is
yes.
That kind of the basis of it.
I'm using Superior Drummer 3 to kind of play and program people's stuff. It's just because I had the ambition of trying to get drum mics and everything set up, like a recording situation figured out for my real drums, but I just haven't done it yet. And then up until I want to say maybe like a month or two ago, I was waiting on a second interface to be able to mic up everything that I needed. And I also needed something that could be tethered to or whatever, like combined and like I was saying, it was like I had Black Dahlia stuff that I had to worry about, and that all came together so quick. It was like we had 2 weeks of planning, and then 2 weeks later we were going to be filming and recording, and that's what we did.
Whoa.
And then, like I said, I got sick.
Fuck,
and
man.
Then it was the holidays, and then I came home from that and have just been like dealing with other stuff. And so I am definitely trying to get my recording rig set up, because I would like to start doing, I don't know, like drum covers and just like various other cool stuff that would be nice to have like a recording set up with.
Yeah.
But so I'm just doing the programming for right now until I can get that figured out.
Yeah. And how was the live stream situation? Because I guess it wasn't actually, obviously, it wasn't 100% live, obviously, because
you couldn't have been
in all those places at once, obviously. But
no way, man, it's Hollywood magic. We were just like switching set scenes and like, you know,
incredible,
wardrobe,
incredible,
changes.
Like something on Broadway, like The Lion King or something.
Exactly. I mean, that's all they did in the fucking 60s and 70s, and we just utilized that magic.
but you're one of the few people I've actually spoken to who's done a live stream. Like how was that compared to a regular show / tour preparation situation? You're just telling me, obviously, it was very last minute. It was a couple of weeks, fucking
it
zero
was.
to everything in 2 weeks. Was it similar to prepping for a tour or prepping for a show, or like was it completely different? Like, what was the experience like? Was it weird?
Yeah, and it was like prepping for a tour that you have been procrastinating on doing forever. And so it feels like a nightmare scenario where you're like, oh my God, this is literally what I have dreams about, where I like get, you know, last second notice and I haven't touched the drums in months.
Yeah,
and,
oh shit, yeah.
Now I gotta do the thing. But like, luckily, you know, I've been playing those songs for 8 years at this point, and so a lot of it came back, and we decided to do a lot of the traditional ones that we normally do, so that helped a lot. And and then of course it was nice too, because we didn't have the pressure of like playing that live type of stream where, you know, you are literally what comes out of your instrument is like what's gonna go to the audience. And it was good because everybody's kind of like off in their own lives right now. It's like Brian got a job, and I'm sure Max is working. Max is like always working. He's always got something going on. He's got his own businesses, and he's always keeping busy no matter what. I don't know exactly what everyone else is doing, but we all just had to kind of like, you know, really knuckle down and learn the stuff quickly.
Yeah.
And then I think that this format of live stream, we all preferred, because there's just something about watching like a band in a live scenario playing to no one and just kind of like trying to feed off of that energy. And it's sort of like when you, to us, or at least the way that I believe that we feel about it is like, it was kind of like a music video scenario versus
absolutely.
And it's like you can bring the energy and not feel so self-conscious about your performance and stuff. It was like we I mean, every one of those songs that we played, it, we're all playing it. It's just obviously music video chopped up and everything, but all of that audio is from those sessions. And
so you still have the kind of pressure of a live show, but kind of mixed with the kind of the, yeah, as you say, you can kind of get into it a bit more without worrying too much because it's not completely live. And hopefully there's no technical difficulties. You don't have to worry about that kind of shit. You can, if you need to do it again, you can do it again. And I assume so. Or did you just play through it all once? Or did you do a couple of takes? And
we
or
did.
Am I not allowed to know the secrets?
Oh, I'm sure. You know, any person who has like a basic understanding of this shit would understand. But like,
yeah,
we just did like each song like four times, and and it was like, yeah, we would run through the set like just every song once, and then do that four times. And yeah, it helped. And it, of course, you know, like I was saying, it's like we've all just been in our own worlds. It's not been the easiest thing to stay brushed up on all this material. And so you kind of just want to be like peak performance, because, you know, when you got a job and whatever, it's hard to balance that kind of like practice schedule that you would normally keep for like going on tour and whatever. But yeah, I think like this turned out really well. Like I loved it because we could change all those settings and it looked really good.
It was killer, man. It was so good. Yeah.
Thank you.
Great.
And it just allowed us to have like cool little in between things like we did as well, you know, like having Neil Hamburger as a host and having George be on to do the,
oh, that was so
the sketch.
Good.
Yeah. We were really stoked that he agreed to do that. And when we were tossing around ideas, like he was one of the first people that we considered actually for a host of the thing. And but we knew we wanted him in there in some fashion.
But no, man, I feel like, you know, I genuinely feel you guys brought something very different to the whole live show. It was almost like, you know, it was kind of a continuation of the previous DVD type situations that the band had. It was like, you know, like a kind of a live stream version of a DVD kind of thing, which was cool. It was more than just a show. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, right. And I think that's what we wanted to do too. We wanted to bring something different to the table. We wanted to stand out and not just do the same thing that everyone else was doing and keep it visually entertaining. And then we do get a lot of people talking about how they really enjoy the DVDs and they want more all the time. And, you know, we're always like, well, we don't know if we're going to do that or when we're going to do that. And
they take a long time to put together and they're expensive and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, exactly. And it just, you know, and then you got to keep like demand high for those. So you can't be putting out like one a year or whatever. But this was a good excuse. Yeah, it was a good excuse to like just kind of add on to the library of silliness.
I was going to say that as well, because you guys released Verminous right at the start of all this shit. Right, like just as all this lockdown stuff happened, that was pretty much when Verminous came out, right? So you guys didn't really tour on this at all, right, on the last album?
Yeah, right. We actually went down to South Africa the week that the world was ending, and it was like the day that we came back to the States after we were done was the day that they said, okay, everybody's gonna go into quarantine. And you know,
you came back. Oh my god.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we had insane. Just played like Verminous and that song Child of Night for the very first times ever in those two shows that we did down there. And that's the only time we played them. And then it was on this Yule Mall. And so it was really weird because I've had to learn those songs like three different times now this past year to be like, you know, play it for a day and then do nothing
time,
with it.
Yeah. And hope it goes okay and then never play it again.
Yeah, exactly. So I can't wait to relearn it again when tours come back around.
When the next one-off show happens.
yeah, exactly. And they're like, oh, Texas reopened completely, COVID spike. We're all back to basic quarantine for the next three months.
Exactly. But yeah, do you feel like, because I remember when it came out and it was kind of, it was one of the only releases around that kind of time, especially in the extreme metal, from my memory anyway, I might be wrong, in the extreme metal world, one of the only releases. And it felt like it was almost, obviously it wasn't a good thing that you guys couldn't tour, but it almost felt like a good thing that you guys were kind of one of the only bands that were that was still releasing their album, because so many bands, Carcass included, were delayed their releases because of it and blah, 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 blah. And you guys just released it. And it seemed like it was a fucking great idea, because everybody seemed to love it, and it seemed to be going to, like, you know, not number one, but you know what I mean? Like, it was doing really well in the charts and all kinds of shit. And did you feel like, was that kind of a conscious decision, you know? Or were you just like, well, that's when it's going to be released, so let's just do it and just see what happens?
I think that we decided to keep the release date because it was supposed to coincide with a tour with Testament that never ended up happening, obviously. And at that point, we had already delayed the album, I believe, twice. Like, our initial release was supposed to be January. And then this was back in, I want to say, August, that we had thought that it would probably be January, because we were having a little bit longer of a time putting the album together, getting all the mixes finalized, and getting the masters done and all that stuff than we had anticipated. And so then I think they wanted to push it, like I said, to coincide with that tour. And then everything started kind of falling apart, and it was hard to make any sort of, I think, calls at the time, because it was just like, when we got back from that tour that week, we were just kind of all like, okay, well, what is going to happen next? Like, is this only going to last for like 3 months? Is, you know, what's the time frame on everything? And I think we just didn't want to delay it any more than we had to. And so it just made sense to release it then and not try to push it way into the year and lose momentum.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it seemed to work, again, from an outsider's perspective. It seemed like everyone just went crazy because they were like, thank fuck they haven't delayed. At least one band is releasing their album when they said they were going to.
Yeah, that's true. I'm sure our fans would have probably done some, like, Metalocalypse proportionate destruction if we hadn't.
Yeah, exactly. You guys too? Everyone else and you too?
Yeah, right.
But I remember speaking to you, like, I think it was, I can't remember when it was, but we spoke briefly around the time that you were kind of writing the drum parts for it, and you were on tour, and you took your electronic kit on tour with you, and were you writing, or were you practicing for the studio? What was the situation there? I just remember it being absolutely crazy.
Oh,
and
dude,
it sounded like a nightmare.
It absolutely was. It was one of the toughest recording scenarios I've had to deal with. We had virtually like 60 days of touring consecutively, and I think we may have had 3 to 4 days off within those 60 days. And we did a full European run, and then as soon as we were done with that, we flew to Mexico and did a festival there for a day, and then we came back home to the US and had to start like a 3-week tour with Meshuggah. And so it was like, when the tour started for Europe, that was in April, and you know, being a drummer, you can't touch a drum kit that entire time. And I mean, at least to practice, because you're just setting up for the show, and then you leave it, and that's it. And so I was still kind of trying to write parts just on my computer, and trying
like programming them.
Just click the blocks and whatever. Yeah, and it's like, that stuff is okay. Sometimes it helps to clear your ideas up when you are forced to like click, you know, everything and not just go wild or whatever. But there's other times too where, you know, you want to get on a kit and be like, well, what can I do, or what just comes out of me naturally? And sometimes it's better than just what you're gonna think logically versus what's in your muscle memory. And so I brought my electronic kit on tour, and that was a huge pain, because I still don't use drum tech. I just do everything myself. So I was like loading in and setting up my drum kit, and then having to set up my electronic kit. And then the worst part was like, Meshuggah and us were the only two bands on these shows. And so like, you know, normally if you're like an opener or some kind of support, you'll have more time in a night to get to, you know, be backstage and be in your room that stuff. And this was just like, nope, you guys are on. And then they're going to play for like an hour and a half or something. And then before they're even done, you should be like loaded out and out. And so I was just, I get into the venue, set up all my shit, set up my electronic kit, try and play that for a little bit, then do sound checks, then go eat dinner, then play the show, then get back in the room and keep trying to like learn slash write stuff for the album. And then I get home and I have 3 weeks to now learn all the stuff that I didn't have any time to do, which is the whole album, before I go into the studio.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That is literally hell.
Yeah, man, it was brutal as fuck. And shout out to fucking Onnit supplements, the Alpha Brain, the stuff that Joe Rogan pumps. I know that some people are skeptical of it and, you know, think it's a bunch of snake oil or whatever, but I really fucking, I think, could like do a lot more than I possibly could have on my own with that shit. Like, I mean, just my focus was, you know, very strengthened, and like I was able to not hit that mental wall and just like keep absorbing.
And that's
when
you really, really needed it, I guess, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it was just like, dude, I was learning shit on the e-kit. I brought it to the studio as well, because then the other part of it is like, okay, now your drums are all mic'd up and you've got all the tunings and everything correct. So now, you know, you can't sit there and bang
and
away
around
on that.
Yeah.
So I had to go on the e-kit, learn the stuff, turn around onto the live kit, and then try to record whatever I just learned. And so it
on
was
the
like
fly,
double,
pretty much.
It was like double the work. It sucked.
that's fucking crazy. Did you find like in the studio, was there still a lot of stuff that you hadn't written or didn't quite know then? Were you kind of still learning as you were going, or was it just stuff that you hadn't quite finished writing yet?
Well, I made sure to try and finish writing before I got into the studio, because I knew that I was gonna need to have it all figured out if I had any chance of trying to learn that stuff before getting in. And it was just it was such a hefty workload of learning the entire album for the first time, like, I mean, really getting it into my limbs, and especially like having consecutive time to work on it where I wasn't on tour anymore. And so when I got into the studio, I had like I said, those 3 weeks to learn stuff, and I just kind of decided to attack it by learning all the most difficult stuff the best that I could, because my other strategy was just to learn one song a day, and it would have been 21 days plus 13 songs. You know, you're going to touch a handful of those songs one time and you won't retain anything. So I knew half of it and then had to learn the other half in the studio.
Damn, that's so insane.
Oh, I know, dude. It was like, I just wanted to curl up in the fetal position
and just sleep,
you know, cry.
I don't blame you. And how do you normally learn songs? Are you just are you a note taker, or do you just kind of listen to it as many times as you can until you get it, or have you got like your own special thing?
So I've been trying to figure that out for a while, because as a kid, like, I never really sat down and took practicing and learning things that seriously. It used to be just plug in your iPod and try and get as far through the song as you can, and when you like stumble over this one part, you have to just keep rewinding it by like 3 seconds and listening and trying and
slow and it down and blah blah blah.
So now, like, what I've been trying to do, at least with Dahlia stuff, is programming those parts and having all the drum parts written out has helped so much, because it's like I can solo the drums, I can read the drum MIDI, I can slow stuff down, I can loop certain sections, and then it's like that is always there for me as a reference when I need to go back and learn it. So even now with some other songs that I've had to learn, I've been writing out the drum MIDI and then just attacking it that way. Like, you know, I've already written it, so I basically know the structure and I can read it, and I know how parts go for sure. And then I just kind of like will loop the really hard stuff and then try to combine it with the previous stuff that I know and just kind of keep dividing it into sections and looping them on time limits and stuff.
And then kind of mashing it all together when you know everything individually well enough, then just kind of piecing it all together when you feel you're ready. Yeah. Wow, that's cool, man. And I've never really thought about it that way. I've never really used MIDI that much, but it makes a lot of sense because I guess you can just listen to a drum track too. So instead of having the entire track playing or like a shitty kind of guitar player, I don't know what Brian and Brandon are like for programming drums, but generally from my experience, no offense guitar players, but guitar players don't often program the best drums. If you listen to, a shitty demo program drums, it's just a bit like, oh, well, this isn't helping me learn anything.
Yeah.
If you have like your own programmed stuff, that must be really, really quite helpful, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everything, like you said, that's the case. And like I said, being able to read, like I can't read notated music, and it just looks so intimidating to me in order to be like, yeah, same, oh, that's dude. A dotted 16th note. I totally know what that sounds like, looking at it. And so it's like being able to read and know at least the patterning of like what the hits are going to be like. So it's like, oh, snare to toms to back to snare to like whatever. And then you've got being able to hear it, so you can know exactly what this looks like, what it sounds like. And then, solo out the track and just focus on what you had there and what you're supposed to play. It's amazing. So I think like I do kind of learn through seeing and hearing. And so that's like helped me learn stuff a lot quicker. The other thing that helps a bunch is I take the MIDI that they've written and it allows me to keep, a big majority of what they want. And especially because Brian will write stuff that, I've had problems because I had to replicate what he did in the past. Like he didn't send me the MIDI. And so I would just, and stupidly, I wasn't even thinking to ask him like, hey, can you send me the MIDI file? Because then I wouldn't have to literally build it from scratch and take all that time to do it. And in the past when I've done it that way, I've missed out on like, he wants a kick, like specifically on this 1/16th beat or something. And I'm like, okay, well, that totally was not something that I thought was significant, but you feel it and you hear it in this certain way. Yeah, so, exactly. And I've had to like go over to his house and be like, okay, so where exactly did you want that kick? Because I'm not like hearing it correctly or managing to like put it in the place that, you want it. And so, if he sends over the MIDI, I can just like throw in my fills and adjust certain things here and there. And then I've got like the original file and I can just throw that back in if I screw anything up too much. And then my work, like writing the part is significantly, lowered because it's already done.
Most of it's done. The kind of the basic, like this bit's a blast section, this bit's a thrash set. That's already done. You don't have to program.
Oh yeah. It's so obnoxious.
But like when it comes to writing, what's the, is it kind of an all-in situation? Like from the drum perspective, is it kind of an all-in situation? Like does everybody pitch in or are you kind of mainly in charge of the drum area with a few kind of directions from the other guys? Or is it more like a kind of everybody gives critique on everything? Or are you kind of, more in control?
I would say it's mainly Brian and Brandon kind of like deciding on what they want out of the track. Some tracks they're like, very specific about what they want through a majority of it. And then other tracks, sometimes, I'll have more leeway to do a little bit different stuff. And occasionally Trevor throws his two cents in about like, oh, I think the drums should do a build up here, or I think like this should go back to a blast beat or something like that. And that's like always a curveball for me because generally, like if I get approval from Brian and Brandon, I'm like, okay, cool, I'm in the clear. Like, I can roll with this. And then there's always that last minute, like, you know, unexpected change. And I'm like, oh, God damn it. So I have to go back and change something else. But like, in the end, you know, obviously everyone just wants it to sound good for the track. And so I try to, like, you know, throw in as much as I can or want to. And it's just, it's not always going to be approved because I have certain ideas and so do they, and, you know, all that.
It's still a group, quote unquote, group effort at the end of the day, I guess. And everybody wants to make the song sound the best, in theory, anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And that totally depends on, you know, I mean, art is subjective. So it's like, if they're hearing this in their head and you're hearing this in your head, then, you know, it depends on what their influences are, what they care to hear for that, and, you know, so on and so forth.
Yeah, and I guess everybody's got completely different, as you say, like, influences in different ways. Like, I definitely notice when, you know, when I'm writing with Carcass or whatever, and they will give me a drum idea, I'm like, whoa, that's not the kind of thing a drummer would normally play.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's so outside the realms of what drummers do. Do you know what I mean? But it's when I play it and we kind of figure it out and we meet in the middle, it sounds like something that Carcass would do. So I'm like, oh, that's obviously, you know, that's their influence making it sound like that, you know? Whereas if it was a bunch of just drummers, it would never sound like that because they're all thinking about, well, this isn't what drummers would play technically.
Yeah, believe me, I've felt the same thing, and it's definitely one of those, like, I don't know, even sometimes when you hear it on the demo, you're sort of like, yeesh, I don't know about that, and then you start playing it on the kit or whatever, and you're like, oh, okay, you know, this isn't, I guess, that bad, like, this sounds bad, like it could actually work.
Yeah, exactly. I guess this is the constant battle of drummers and guitar players, right, is they're both trying to get their ideas across and meeting somewhere in the middle.
Well, dude, I also have to say that MIDI has helped tremendously with that, with conveying your ideas, because before it was so tough to have to spend all this time practicing something and learning it just so that way it could get shot down. And it was like, I mean, that's just disheartening, you know, from start to finish.
Especially when you love it, like, you can get really excited about a part too, right? And then you bring it to the practice room and they're like, nah.
Yeah.
You're like, what? I spent like 4 weeks coming up with that.
Exactly. So it's awesome to be able to. And the other thing is like, when you can't play it 100% like in the pocket or whatever it is, but you're like, well, if I just have, like, you know, a few months to learn this, it's going to sound fucking awesome.
It's going to be sick.
And they're like, well, from what I can tell of this thing that I can't understand, it sucks already. So, like, I'm not into this. And you're like, no, man, you just don't know what it could be. And so it's helped a lot to be able to, like, not put any time or effort into learning something, but being like, hey, would you want something like this? And then they can say yes or no.
This is what it could sound like. If I practiced it 2 more months, this is what it would sound like.
Yeah.
And you don't need to practice it for 2 months. You could just give it to them, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, dude, and then the albums are basically, they come out and it's like, well, this is what it would sound like if I could, you know, I mean, like, once we go on, like, the second tour, it'll be awesome.
Yeah. Oh, man. Do you find that too? Like, I've always noticed this, that probably after, I don't know, maybe like 6 months of constantly playing a song or a group of songs from a newer album, not only am I more comfortable with it, but I play stuff that's much better than I did on the album. So I'll be like, you know, playing it live, I'll be like, that feel kind of sucks. And then slowly over the course of a couple of months, I'll be like, that feels much better. I should have done that. Fuck, why didn't I do that? And that's the worst, man.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're always going to have that regardless, because you're just always going to have those different influences over time and the different perceptions of the song as you played a million times over, and it's inevitable. But yeah, I totally get that. And then I just kind of, like, work it into the set. I'm just like, well, if they're coming to see it live, then they can hear the cool thing that I'm doing now, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And then every now and again you get a little, like, strange eye from the guitar player, like, what the fuck was that?
Yeah, right.
That's not what you did last night.
Yeah, and like I don't know how much you improv in the middle of shows and stuff, but I'm pretty like muscle memory at this point, so it's kind of like if I do anything different, they're gonna hear it like the first practice, and then usually it's just gonna be that way for the rest of the tour. Yeah.
I was gonna say, are you more like, do you like to be that way? Do you like to have a kind of like set routine kind of thing, or are you into improvising a little bit, or do you feel kind of more comfortable with the muscle memory situation?
As far as things have gone with the band, they have always felt most comfortable with just having a completely set idea of what's going to happen, because they want to know exactly like how the fills are going to be. And it's, yeah, and like in previous bands and stuff, I had done some improvising, and it's like, it's fun, but it can also be nerve-wracking, because sometimes you're oh shit, totally misjudged that one, and like, you know, landed a little weird or whatever. Yeah. But it just makes like practicing sometimes a little bit better, because you know exactly what you're going to do. But then it also kind of makes live shows a little nerve-wracking, because you're like, oh god, okay, so I'm going to do this fill right here, and then I got to do this whole beat, and then I got to do this specific fill right here, and you know, everything's specified, so you don't want to like fuck up or forget or whatever, you know.
I guess, but as well with, you know, with music as fast as Dahlia's, though, it's not the easiest thing to improvise anyway.
Yeah.
So I guess it's kind of, it's probably not the end of the world that it's, you know, it is kind of mapped out in that way, because improvising at what's kind of the average tempo of most of the tracks, like 230, 240?
Actually, those are in the higher range. I would say it's mainly like 220 to maybe 200.
Okay.
And then sometimes slower.
Faster for some reason, but yeah. But even then, like improvising just at that tempo isn't the easiest, especially live on stage with intricate guitars going. And you know, you don't want to be in that situation where you're just improvising all over the place.
Oh, God. Yeah. It's, I mean, when I was in, Abigail Williams, the way that the drumming is written for that band, from like Ken Bedeni in Aborted, he just plays like, I mean, he for sure, when he wrote on that Abigail album, In the Absence of Light, he was like in the studio just improvising the whole thing. And it's like unbelievable the shit that just comes out of him. And he just flows when he plays with Aborted and stuff.
But when I
came in after Ken, and I had to learn all of his parts and learn how to play like that style. And holy shit, dude, that gets really difficult. Like, you got to be able to feel that type of shit to flow with that technicality.
Yeah, yeah. And again, the tempo is a big thing. Like, you can't overlook how... Yeah, playing speed is one thing, but playing speed fluidly and playing speed with like kind of style, it's a whole other ball game, isn't it? Like, anyone can kind of sit with a pad and learn how to play fast, but to be able to play fast creatively and fluidly and just with feel is like, that takes a lifetime. Like, it really does.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always want to do that type of stuff. And I think that that would be very tricky as well, because like you said, anybody could just do singles real fast across stuff. And I mean, that's difficult, but when you start adding a little bit more groove and flair to what you want, then that's where it's like, okay, yeah, you better really have some great, like, I don't know, improvisation foundation with this shit, because you are gonna
jazz
like
shit going on.
Yeah, you're gonna, like, trip sprinting essentially.
Yeah, exactly, face first.
Yeah.
Quite easily. But like, so from how long were you with Abigail Williams for? Was it a relatively short you jumped into Dahlia?
It was literally September 2011 to 2012.
Oh wow, so 1 year.
Yeah. And it was the band was just kind of naturally coming to an end, and and then luckily, like, Ryan Knight knew Ken from when he was in Arsis, and just came to a show and happened to see me play and asked Ken if you know, it'd be cool to try me out for Dahlia since our band was splitting up. And and then it just kind of went from there.
And yeah, the rest is history kind of thing.
Yeah.
As it were. Yeah. And like, from Abigail to Black Dahlia, did Did that feel like a massive step up? Like, I mean, in terms of kind of touring schedule alone, I think, you know, Dahlia have always been known to be like massive tourers. And I don't know how much touring you were doing with Abigail Williams. Like, did it feel like a huge jump for you? Like, was there a lot of stuff that you learnt just from switching from one band to the other?
Yeah, absolutely. There was, Abigail was like the first band, even though short-lived, that I was doing consistent touring with. And I was still pretty new to it. The band that I was in previous, you know, we'd only done like two-week tours. And then I had been in another band before, and we had only done maybe, I don't know, like three or four tours. And some of those were only a couple weeks and stuff. So yeah, Abigail, there's a lot more going on, but we did long tours, and where it was like the last one we did was like 3 months, and then or 2.5 or something, and then
you did some long stuff with them as well. Wow.
Yeah, and that was like a little unexpected, because that was a DIY thing, and we had done two tours, like with one with Deicide and one with Mayhem, and so those were big audience, like professional tours with, you know, 30 to 40 days a piece. And, but when I got into Dahlia, it was a big change. Cause I had never done that kind of consistent touring. And, those were the first times that I ever like left the country. I mean, like, or left the continent, I guess. And, getting to play with, big bands and playing in big venues consistently, and nothing is DIY and everything is like very professional. It was kind of strange to get used to that, where it's like, oh my God, you mean like things happen the way they're supposed to happen every day?
Oh wait, there's someone organizing that? Wow.
Yeah. There's a guy who I can complain to and he gives a shit.
Yeah, exactly. Not just my girlfriend or my mom.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess, like, because I was talking about this with Krim, whenever it was last week, whenever I spoke to him, but like there's such a, especially when you're kind of, yeah, because we were all young when we joined our kind of, you know, first big bands, and it's kind of like you go from, there's that whole analogy of being dropped in at the deep end of the pool, you know, and I totally felt like that when I first joined Aborted when I was 18, I think I was 18. So, and it was, I was, you know, the greenest of green that you can imagine, and it's like, this is how this works. So I have to use your drum kit every day. I can't bring my whole drum kit with me. And, and you've got a 19-piece drum kit. And, you know, just like, it's all the little things like that that no one teaches you, and you can't learn until you get out there. And you're like, oh, shit, this is how this works. I always wondered how that worked.
Yeah, and, like, I used to feel really shitty about it, because I came from a really small town too. Like, I lived in Wyoming, and I doubt that you guys have seen much of Wyoming, like just coming over here on US tours and shit, because it's like the most it's the most glossed over state. Like, you'll probably never play a show there, but I bet you've driven through there and almost died.
Is there lots of mountains or not really? Is
it yeah,
like, yeah, it's, okay,
it's like on the east side of the, or I'm sorry, the west side of the state, like around the Utah and Idaho border. That's where there's a lot of mountains, and then it kind of starts to level out the further east you get, but it's still rocky. And it's a very small population out there. Like, I think there's only a few million people who live in the entire state. And so growing up and playing shows out there was everything was like a treat for us, because if we got any national acts to come through and play shows, and especially like when my local bands could play those shows, it was just like so fucking awesome. And it was our only taste of like what it was like to play professional shows, because other than that, you know, you're not like in a major city where there are many different groups that sound really fucking cool that you can learn from, and that are doing things like bigger and better than you are, that, you know, you learn everything. And just so when I started touring and getting into all these other bands and those situations, everything was like a learning situation where I was like, man, I am so far behind on all of this. Like, I don't know anything that anyone does. I remember when I first got my like trigger set up, and I was just like, this is so cool. I don't know what to do with it, though.
But it looks cool, and everyone uses one, so it must be cool.
Yeah, and I'm using the stupidest setting for, like, triggering my kick. It might as well be, like, a 909 or something, and I'm just going to go, like, run that through the PA.
Do I remember the first time I did it? It was, like, my first proper show that some local band I was playing in. But we got, like, opening slot on an all-day festival where Napalm Death were headlining. And we were the first band, and that, like, the in-house front of house guy was like, yeah, so, you know, can you just give me some drums? And, like, I was, I don't know, like 16, and I was like, this is my fucking moment. Like, there was no one in the venue, obviously. It was just the opening band at like 2 PM, and I just fucking ripped like a solo. and the dude was like, yeah, okay. Like he spoke over me while I was doing it. He was like, okay, that's good. And I was just like, yeah. But now I'm like, oh my God, what a fucking idiot I was.
Just kick, please.
Yeah, exactly. But it's that kind of shit, isn't it? It's those kind of things you learn, like, oh, they don't want to hear me play all the time in soundcheck.
Like, yeah, exactly. And it's stupid little things like that you look back on, you're like, oh man, I feel so embarrassed. But it's like, what can you do? You know, like, when you get into those situations, it's great and it's awesome that, you know, you and I have gotten to start our careers very early, and like, of course you have to go through a learning phase. It kind of sucks when you're a little bit older and it's like what everybody else or a majority of people who had bigger scenes and stuff learned when they were like 16, you're learning at like 19, 20, and it's just like, well, you know, it's got to be at some point.
Exactly. And again, like, we still learned all that stuff young, really, I guess, you know, because we're lucky enough that we've learned it. Like, there's people that unfortunately never get to be in the situation we've been in. So I guess we are incredibly lucky. Like we said, this whole situation has kind of helped me realize how fucking cool touring is.
Yeah, definitely.
But so when you did the first album with Dahlia, that was Everblack, right?
Yeah.
Did you have much input when you first joined? Were you just like... were you just kind of doing what you were told back then, or what were you already kind of given some freedom to mess around?
So at the time it was difficult because I was already on tour with them, and about halfway through the tour, they asked me if I wanted to record the next album with them. And so I said yes. And they gave me the demos to the songs. And at this point, you know, I'm completely new to all this stuff. And then, of course, this is 2012. So it's like the setups for everyone's, you know, at home shit, like having tune tracks and having like an ability to program drums and whatever. It's not as common as it is like now. And so, all I could do was listen to those tracks while I was on tour and kind of make mental notes of like, okay, this is what this sounds like, and maybe this is what I would do. And then I got, you know, that was another really difficult situation where the tour had gotten set back a little bit in the beginning because of like the first date literally getting flooded. And we had to, it was crazy. It was like a big hurricane rolling in. And so we ended up having to start like maybe 3 or 4 days, maybe 5 too, into the tour, and started at a different venue and all that. But like, by the end of it, you know, we had tacked on more time. And so I got home, I had 2 weeks to record or to figure out what I was going to do for the album and learn the songs. Wow. So that was another scenario where I was just like,
This seems to be a common theme with
it's pretty tough. Like
because you guys tour so hard that I guess you have to just squeeze everything in when you can.
Yeah, man. And like, it's you know, And I've been wanting to kind of like start bringing an electronic kit on tour and being able to have that consistently, because it's just, yeah, those types of scenarios, you're like, dude, I don't want to come home anymore and start learning it for the first time, or to really starting to get it before, under my yeah exactly. And so this scenario wasn't too different than that, and like I ended up like learning the parts when I got home in 2 weeks, and then I was like spending like 5 hours trying to learn / write the stuff that I wanted to do, and then I would record that, and then I would go to my practice spot for like another 3 to 4 hours afterwards and try and like learn the shit that I had done the days previous, just so I could keep everything together. And it was pretty brutal as well. And but because of that, with the limited ability to really like think about those songs and learn those songs, I kind of like threw some suggestions in on certain things, and it was just stuff that was like, I don't know, that Brian didn't want for some of the feels and whatever. Like I remember I wanted to like halftime some part, it was going to for like the march part of the intro to the album, like the very first song in Hell.
And
I was gonna do like some sort of Contagion thing, and it was just like, well, that's not really gonna fit just the way that this is written. And I kind of like learned my own fills, tried to like learn the parts as best as possible, and just like was like, you know, you can't win them all in terms of like getting to put your stamp on shit. Like it's just, I'm just going to try and record these to the best of my ability and like get the drums done, you know, for them. And then at some point in the future, then hopefully I'll be able to like put a little bit more of my stamp on this.
Yeah. And I get, well, it seems to me like that has happened, because progressively I feel like with each album, you've kind of either you've developed with the band or you've kind of brought more of your own thing in. But like there's definitely a kind of an Alan Cassidy sound, I think, with the band now. Like you've definitely got a thing going that's really unique. Like especially your cymbal stuff, dude. Your cymbal stuff, so fucking, it's crazy.
Oh, thank you, man. Yeah, that comes from a lot of learning that black metal style, especially with Abigail Williams. Like it, a lot of that black metal stuff is so cymbal heavy with the rhythms and everything. And I just really liked those intricate little ideas that get sprinkled into all those songs. And and I've been trying to, you know, learn how to write for the parts and write with the band and stuff. And so it's definitely been a growing process for me as a musician and me being like in this band, because I want to be able to put what I want, but also make it sound good according to what's happening. And again, like the MIDI stuff has helped tremendously, because I can hear the ideas that I have and I can know right away, like, is this going to be good? Does this actually fit? And I can be like a spectator rather than like the performer who's like, oh, I just did this really complex fill / beat, but it actually isn't good, you know?
As far as your practice these days, I mean, I'm assuming, like, do you still kind of practice, quote unquote, on a regular basis? Like, do you try and, are you trying to, have you got goals, or are you just kind of, you're just kind of playing for fun? Are you still kind of practicing, or are you just kind of playing at the moment?
So I'm kind of doing a mixture of both. I haven't been super disciplined about what I am trying to accomplish. It's been, just because it's been like, well, I've got these drum covers to learn, and I've got, commission stuff to do and whatever. But I've been trying to kind of like work on some of my weak areas. I just found a video on YouTube of Jim Chapin, and he studied under, I can't remember what his first name is, but Moeller. And he basically...
So
he has a whole video on the Moeller technique, and that's what I use. And I've been wanting to strengthen my left hand for a while, because it works fine for what I need it to do, but it just doesn't feel uniform with my right hand. So it's been kind of weird because without the consistency too of like playing a lot of fast stuff, I can't quite tell if learning the proper technique for my left is kind of like throwing me for a curve and it's feeling weird now, or if it's like, well, you also haven't been like, you know,
yeah,
trying to strengthen it, but I want to do that.
I guess that's a thing that I guess is pretty paramount with speed drumming, which I guess maybe isn't talked about. I guess it is talked about a lot. I'm not really sure, but the maintenance aspect of it is so important. Like, I mean, I don't play anywhere near as fast as you, obviously, with Carcass, but when I was back playing with Aborted and stuff, like, if I'd take a week or two off, you know, it would be like, fuck.
Yeah.
You know, playing at the faster tempos. Like, if you didn't practice for 2 weeks, you had a show, then you didn't play for 2 weeks, then you had another show, it was like, oh, shit, it feels like I haven't played for 2 years, not 2 weeks. Like,
yeah, and I luckily was able to get back to a pretty good place before we did the Dahlia stuff for Christmas. And but yeah, it definitely took me, you know, like about 45 minutes or something of like running through speed exercises like every day for a month to just get to that comfortable place again. And so yeah, I've been trying to kind of maintain on that, trying to like build that technique to hopefully get better speed with my left hand too. And then I have been just trying to kind of learn like various little things, like trying to keep time with my left foot on the hi-hat while I'm like soloing around, and you know, just really fundamental kind of stuff that never put time into.
Yeah, man. And it's, I think, and that's the kind of stuff that it's, I mean, when you're touring, especially as much as you guys did, that's the kind of stuff that kind of drops off, right? Like the kind of the fundamental stuff, because you always have to be in touring shape, you have to play exactly what you need to play, and everything else kind of has to wait. Like all the stuff you want to work on just kind of has to wait until you have the time, but you rarely seem to have the time, and you're just like, ah, shit, one day I'll work on that.
Yeah, and that's another reason why I'd really like to bring my electronic kit on tour, because I don't feel that they're is much that can compete with the feel of having like your kit set up in front of you and having those real sounds. I mean, like you can get pads and stuff and you can get far with pads, but trying to remember to like, oh, this is the rack tom, or oh, I'm going to use this as a hi-hat or something. And you just don't have those audio like cues to go off of. It's tough.
Mm. Yeah. But, and I guess, and that's thinking of positives with this whole bullshit situation is that you know, people like us who we can actually play what we want to play now, which is quite nice. I mean, not that what we were playing before wasn't what we want to play, but it's as we're saying, it's stuff that you wish you could have practiced more over the years. And now I'm fine, like with you, I'm trying to bring in my hi-hat foot, because I've never done that before, really. And it's so much harder than it seems.
Oh, absolutely. And the main guy who you hear it all the fucking time and it sounds so great is Thomas Hake from Meshuggah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You don't even realize it. And then when you watch him, you're like, oh, shit, he's keeping time with his left foot as well.
Yeah. And just doing all those weird patterns with his right foot. And like, but then when he's doing all the tom beats and then the weird accents on the cymbals, it's like you've just got that like constant aether.
Yeah, exactly. It's incredible. And it adds a whole other kind of, a whole other layer to the sound. Because, again, like, you don't, listening to the albums, you're not quite sure that he's doing that. But when you see him do it, you're like, ah, that makes sense. Because there's like a gluing factor throughout his whole playing. And you're like, oh, it's that. That helps add to the whole kind of, the whole experience of his playing.
Yeah,
something that simple, but it's actually really fucking difficult to do.
Exactly. And to me, it's such a simple thing, but it, I think, takes your drumming and like the sound of it, it takes it so much further, because you can hear and feel like the modulation underneath it, where like you're playing triplets while you're keeping like straight notes on the hi-hat, or like you're moving in and out of time. And it's like, that all sounds pretty cool, you know, no matter what, but it sounds way cooler when you can hear where the pulse is at and just you going nuts on top of it.
Yeah, and it brings it back to, again, like the whole musical side of it, making it musical and making it tasteful. I think it's, you know, if you're just going fucking crazy with no concept of time or groove or whatever, that's, you know, that's one thing. But if you can keep it in relevance to a kind of tempo and a groove, it's like, it's just a whole nother level of drumming, in my opinion. It brings just drumming to kind of a whole musical level where you're just like, damn, yeah, that's where I want to be. Do you know what I mean? Like, I want to be on that level of drumming, not just playing blast beats all the time. Like, I love blast beats, don't get me wrong, but, you know, like,
yeah,
on a level where I can make just the drums sound musical, you know, like.
Yeah, and I've always been very much trying to ride the line between groove and brutality. Like, I love fast shit. I love being able to play fast blast beats and stuff. But I mean, like, Dave Bilya, who plays for Putridity and Xenomorphic Contamination, I think that's what they're called, and like a number of other, I think he's actually playing for Hour of Penance right now too.
Okay.
His shit is unbelievable. He's like so fucking fast, but he has a lot of groove to some of the stuff that he does. And then one guy that I'm like late to the party on, and he does all the left foot timekeeping, is Eloy Casagrande. That guy's fucking unbelievable.
He just kind of makes me sad because he's so good.
I know, man. Like, that, the way he beats his drum kit, it's just like everything's so deliberate, and it's so like groovy, and you just know
so
that he
fluid
means
as well.
Every note.
Yeah. And it's fluid, like, again, and speaking of improvisation, as we did earlier, like, you can tell so much of his stuff is just improvised, but it's so fluid, so controlled, so musical. And I'm like, fuck, dude. And he's younger than us, I think. Like, I think he's like 27 or something. It's fucking crazy. He's really young.
Dude, he's got that Brazilian music background. So, like, he's already got, you know, two legs up on us because of that style of music, man. It's so fucking difficult and demanding in terms of independence and shit.
No, that's cool, man. And it's, as again the positives of this situation are that we can kind of, again, I was speaking to Krim about it. He was saying that he felt like a teenager again because he could just practice whatever the hell he wanted to, and play along to songs and, you know, that weren't his band songs and all that kind of stuff. And it's rare as quote unquote professional musicians that, you know, we get the freedom to just play whatever the hell we want. So it's and work on things like left foot hi-hat timekeeping and all that kind of stuff. Again, our lives, yeah, we can't complain too much because being a fucking professional drummer is pretty sick. So
yeah, and I mean,
we're not
even
complaining,
if I wasn't,
but
it's like I just spent, you know, my days, like, before I got into any touring band, just working in a pizza place and then going and playing drums all night, and I had like no social life. But, you know, it was just, it was awesome getting to work on your skills and learn new shit. And I've got stuff in the pipeline that I want to do for like some drum covers, of learning different stuff that I haven't gotten a chance to learn, and just challenging myself and kind of like just getting to, you know, have fun with that. And then I have another project that I just actually did this past year called Infestuous. And it's like brutal death metal stuff that I recorded like 10 years ago, and I did it on, I recorded a playthrough of one song back in like 2013. It's been on my YouTube this whole time. And we finally got our album done, and I am going to, I already did vocals for the album. And I would love to be able to balance vocals and drums at the same time, but like, I don't know if I have that level of coordination at all.
And that would be so sick.
I have aspirations. I just don't know how realistic they are. But I'm gonna try to learn another song to do a playthrough of that soon. Because that album should be pretty much set to go within, I would say, the next few months. So fingers crossed. But yeah, I'd like to get some of that shit out, man. I wrote some like stupid fast blasting parts for that, like way back when I wrote it, and so now I'm like, oh great, I've only been, you know, topping out at like 250, you know, for like one song in the past like 10 years, and I just haven't been keeping up with like those extreme chops that I used to have. So it's cool. It'll give me something to like, you know, work on and work towards again.
Back to those 45 minute speed workouts every single day.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, I like it too. It's nice to be mindless and be able to watch like TV while you're just doing stupid stuff with your limbs.
Yeah, man. So, right. I've realized I've kept you for quite a long time, but I've got this fun, silly little thing that I like to do. Do you know the either or game?
No, but I'm guessing I can figure out what it is.
Yeah, I give you two things, and you have to tell me what your favorite of those two things is.
Okay, perfect. That's what I figured.
And I've got a little handwritten, dude. Old school. I've got just some general life ones, and then I've got some music/drumming ones.
That's all right.
So should we give it? Are you up for it?
Yes, let's do it.
Okay, cool. Let's do it. Right. So, number one, coffee or tea?
Ooh, I definitely drink way more coffee than tea, but lately it's been making me feel like out of my mind anxious, so I'm thinking about switching to tea, but I do enjoy that that bitter chocolatey cigarette taste.
That kick first thing in the morning.
Yeah.
I respect that. morning or evening? Are you a morning guy or an evening guy?
I would have said evening a few months ago, but man, with no shows and stuff, there's just no reason to be a night owl anymore. It's like everything happens in the day. So now all of a sudden I'm a responsible adult waking up early and I don't even know who I am anymore.
Oh, dude, tell me about it. Like me and Jeff were talking the other day from Carcass, and we were talking about if and when, you know, we start doing stuff again, potentially end of this year, next year, kind of thing. We've potentially got a tour at the end of this year, but whether that will happen, I don't know. I hope it happens, but we shall see. And I just got, we were just talking, and I got this like terrified prang of like, I haven't been to bed past 10:30 in over a year, and I haven't woken up later than like 7 a.m. And I was like, oh my God, am I going to be able to handle it?
Yeah.
I was terrified. Like, oh shit, I've become a different person.
Hey man, well now you can just make the argument, hopefully, that you're all starting to feel each other's age, and maybe you should start doing 7 p.m. shows. I don't know. That
there
might
you
work
go,
out perfectly.
Dude. Yeah, like Sunday matinee shows or something.
Yeah, exactly. That's great. One, maybe three shows a week. I don't know.
Yeah, see, there you go. You know, lots of days off.
Yeah.
Nicer hotels, all that stuff. yeah, right. Sorry, I'm getting distracted from the game. But morning, evening, we've done the one. Summer or winter?
Man, that's a hard one. I guess
they both
I
have positives.
What's that?
They both have their positives, don't they?
Absolutely. I guess I would say summer, because it's just like less clothing that you have to worry about. And I'm in the middle of winter right now, and I'm just kind of like waiting for this to be over so I can go back outside and hang out.
Beach or forest?
I would say beach, because man, I love those crystal clear blue waters and like going down to all those tropical places and just drinking on the beach.
Yeah, dude. A little pina colada or something.
Hell yeah.
right. Chips or chocolate? And obviously I'm aware that I'm British, but all of my guests have been not British so far. So by chips, I mean crisps. I'd call them crisps. So what you refer to as chips. Chips or chocolate?
Right. I guess I would say... Yeah, chips, but it's got to be kettle cooked.
Ah, so specific type of chip. Okay, meat or vegetables?
I guess I've been eating vegan for like the last 2 years, I'd say. I'm not like militant, oh, wow. But I would say, yeah, veggies, just because it's versatile enough that you can make it like meat, and I don't really, you know, see a downside of that. I think it's great.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, man. Respect. Right. YouTube or Netflix?
Ooh. I guess I would say YouTube, just because you could probably find some Netflix stuff or some stuff that it doesn't offer. And then, of course, like, people's weirdo random content could probably be better than exactly. Some Netflix content. So
exactly. And you know, there's just shitloads of drums and music on YouTube, which helps too, I guess.
Definitely. Yeah, that's another thing.
Instagram or Facebook?
Instagram for sure. Like, just
yeah, man.
So for much sure. Cooler stuff and less, I don't know, idiots, I feel like, overall.
Yeah, I feel like there's less opinions on Instagram.
Yeah.
Which is quite nice.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, Coke or Pepsi?
Ooh, Coke for sure. Oh, Pepsi's dude, just yeah. too sweet.
Good. Oh, thank God. I'm so glad you said that. Right, this is the last one of the everyday things. Go for a walk or sit on the couch?
Oh, geez. I think go for a walk at this point. Like, I am practically a pale mole man from quarantine. And my dog even is like, for God's sake, take me on a walk, please. I'm a herding dog and you don't do anything. So I'm ready to see the world again, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. As soon as it warms up a little bit, I guess, as well.
Yeah, yeah. I think that might help a little bit too.
Oh, poor dog. Anyway, right, so these are the music/drummy ones. Got a couple of these. Okay, so studio or live?
Oh, man. I would say live. I think I like it better because there's just that immediate gratification of playing in front of people, and it's just it's great to feel like the thunderous boom of having everything coming through loudspeakers and just then you get to play everything just, you know, kind of once over, and that's all cool. And studio is a lot more, I think, meticulous in terms of like, well, I really want it to sound this way and maybe I could play this better and whatever. It's like, nope, you get one shot and it's over and then you're off stage.
Yeah, you have to live in the moment. You have no other choice. So it's kind of freeing in that way, isn't it?
Yeah, and then you're not just like second guessing yourself a million times because you have the ability to.
Yeah, exactly. I think I probably know the answer to this one, but double pedal or two kicks?
Ooh, you know, I don't really have a preference, to be honest. And it may just be because I use those Pearl Demon drives. And the drive shaft on those are unbelievable. Like, I feel the slightest bit of difference. But when I joined Dahlia, that was the first time that I had used two single kicks regularly, and I actually kind of prefer that now. So I'm gonna say two singles, as long as it doesn't fuck with my tom setup.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, that's the biggest one for me, is I find the rest of the kit harder to play with two bass drums. Like, I find with two single kicks, I find it just completely throws everything out of whack. And I'm just like, oh, this is a bit too far. And no matter how hard I try, I can't quite get it to feel quite as cozy as it does with a double pedal.
And I don't know if you have mounts on your bass drums or whatever, but I think that's kind of one of the key things that is missing when you have that sort of a setup. Just being able to keep everything a little bit more compact and not have to shove stands in places where it just is not working.
Yeah, they don't want to fit. Yeah, exactly. Like, I have my tom stand legs like this when I have a you know, two kick drums, because I guess I like my pedals really close together, and I never realized that until I got until I tried two kick drums, and I was like, shit, these are still like 2 miles apart, even though the bass drums are touching each other.
Right. And then actually, do you do the two kick drums with a double pedal?
I did a little bit. I did for like a year, because I really wanted to like try the double bass drum thing. And then like Carcass refuses to use triggers because obviously it's old school. And like, using, you'll probably understand this, using two bass drums from a rental kit without triggers is a fucking nightmare. Like, tuning them, like, they're from, like, one drum head is barely used, the other drum head has been like punched with a mallet or something, and then like, what, like, the front, they have completely different front drum heads and like, you know, no equal padding. And like, after like five shows, our sound guy was just like, you cannot do this to me. Like, this is taking like, for you to play two bass drums, it's taking like 5 hours just to fucking set up. So I was like, fine, okay, all right, I'll use a double pedal again. So I went back to double pedal. Plus, I couldn't get it feeling comfortable as well. So I just like, I was like, fuck this. This is too much hassle.
Right. And I completely get that. And I just have kind of a irritation seeing drummers who do that. And I'm sure even the drummer probably at some point, if they don't have a tech, is like, why the fuck do I have to lug in two bass drums for the aesthetic? If you're on Twitter with this, you need to add the hashtag normalize single kick double pedals.
It's a movement. I like this.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it makes total sense. Total sense. Anyway, again, we're getting stuck on every single one. These are controversial issues, I feel, that I'm bringing up.
Hey man, I'm feeling pretty heated about it. I would like to bring more, you know, attention to the issue.
To this life-changing issue that we're all having to deal with at the moment.
That's right. And all kick drums are beautiful. That means if you want to use a Roland kick drum for your kick drum because you're just triggering it anyways, do it. It doesn't fucking matter. Who cares?
Exactly. All kick drums are equal.
Yeah. All kick drums matter.
That's the new hashtag. The new movement. Right. Fucking hell, I'm never going to get through all these, am I? Triggers or mics? That can mean triggers across the kit or just kick drum or whatever. Do you have a preference?
Oh, yeah. I would love to hear, like, a great acoustic kit on top and then triggers on bottom. That's fine. Like, unless you're somehow a monster and you can play, like, insane death metal with mic'd up kicks, I still don't think that you could play the shit that I want to hear, which is like, you know, brutal, fast stuff. And, but yeah, like I would say like all death metal albums and most albums, I think that just kick ass for the most part are like really good natural sounding drums. And only like, I would say that Bury Your Dead album, Cover Your Tracks and the Dimmu albums with like Nick, where he triggered the whole thing. That's the only times where I was like, okay, these get a pass. Like the sound's fucking awesome. But
I agree with you. Triggers on bass drums is absolutely, I fucking hate all this shit. Especially when you get to a certain tempo, as you were saying, and you're playing a certain style, prove me wrong, somebody, but you can't use microphones when you get into like 250. Or 270 and you're trying to play singles or you're trying to play like syncopated double bass parts with microphone, it's like, come on now.
I do have great love though for any very well tuned acoustic kick drum, because I mean there's no comparison. And I had to play some of that Abigail Williams stuff, like we were flip-flopping between playing like post black metal shit and like their older stuff, which it's all super fast. And I was on tour playing an acoustic only kick drum that, and I was using my Demon drives with fucking DW 9000 beaters. So like 240 speed.
Literally like weights. Yeah. Oh, 240. Jesus. Dude.
Yeah. And then it just sounded like.
But I guess, you know, it was hitting quite hard because those fucking beaters are like literally like mallets, like baseball bats on the.
Exactly. And then you got to be conscientious because, you know, you have your threshold set so loud, so it's like that's a battle in itself. But yeah.
Oh man, that trigger module settings is a whole podcast in itself, I think.
Absolutely. God.
and electronic drum kit settings too, but yeah, we won't get into that. Right, coated or clear heads?
Ooh, I have really been wanting to play coateds for a little while now, but I guess I just kind of like that thwack of the clear. So I guess I would say clear.
Yeah, makes sense. Right, this one could be polarizing. Blast or groove?
Ooh, damn. You know, I'm like I said, I'm kind of split right down the middle on that one. But yeah. I think at the end of the day, I think I'd rather just hear groove, because it's, you know, a lot of people can play fast nowadays and it's not as challenging or as out of reach as it used to be a long time ago. But to be able to play groove, and man, if you can play groove fast, that's even fucking pretty cool in itself.
Yeah, if you can make a blast beat groove, then that's, you're winning, I guess. That's the
yeah. Oh my God, Kai Hato right there.
Oh, dude, yeah. Again, speaking of mind-blowing drummers. Well, dude, come on. I mean, obviously, we don't want to do the brown-nosing stuff, but you're a fucking incredible drummer. So let's stop saying people are amazing and good, because everybody's good. All drummers are equal.
All drummers matter.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right, I'm going to get through all these. Fuck. Okay, wood snare or metal snare?
Oh, I've been digging the shit out of wood snares lately.
You just
got
some new snares, right? You got a whole bunch of new snares.
Yes, and I actually kind of steered away from doing anything metal for some reason. I don't know. I really liked the sounds that I was hearing from these wood snares, and I just like a lot of that gospel chop sounding stuff. Like all those snares are so punchy and so just focused sounding, and they don't ordinarily have the worst overtones to them. And I got like a G Maple 13 inch from Tama, and then I got a Starphonic Maple and a Kapoor snare, and then I also got a Walnut, and holy shit, I mean, like, I'm in heaven with all those, but like the Walnut sounds so fucking great for like just all around stuff. I couldn't believe it. It's an SLP, so you know, it's a slightly lower line, but still quality, and they have the most diversity with their woods and stuff. And that thing just is so warm, and but it has so much like punch to it. And then that G Maple 13 is just like super fucking punchy, very high, and just super loud. Like all of them have their strengths, but those
monster,
are my favorite.
Isn't it? That's just fucking crack, the 13 G Maple. I've played that a couple of times. It's like, oh, just shotgun.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's I may have to lower it a bit because I feel like it plays better at like faster speeds, but I think you could dial it down a little bit and have it sound good at like more mid tempos and whatnot.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, we're almost there.
Yeah, sorry, I got an anecdote about everything.
No, I like it. I like it a lot. Rack or stands? I know you use a rack, but do you prefer it? Is it just kind of, you know, is it an essential?
I would say yes, just because I really like the idea of not having to tear everything down. It can stay in place. It can be carried off in pieces or carried on in pieces. And yeah, overall, I'd say it's kind of a time and sanity saver. And then stands tend to get tricky, and especially when I don't use them all the time, but you generally have to break those down regardless, you know, of what your scenario is, like put everything down, telescope it down, all that shit. So yeah, I would say stands are a little bit more in the way than I would like them to be.
Yeah, floor space too, like racks take up almost zero floor space, which is quite nice.
Yeah, absolutely.
Versus like 15 stand legs just like spidering.
Yeah, exactly. And then I have to, with certain setups, you know, like duct tape down the feet because it's like leaning over to try and reach to something. It's it's a mess.
China is always the one for me. The right hand China. It's just always falls over or fucking, you know, falls off the riser or like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, that's another thing. Having a riser that's big enough to accommodate all that shit.
Yeah, exactly. Especially when you got, you know, metal drum kits like we like to have. But, right, so 5A's or 2B's? I think I know the answer to this one.
Yeah, I'd have to say 5A's, and it's really just because I just break cymbals all the time, and if I switch to 2B's, man, I would be like doubling or tripling my annual orders through Sabian. Also, there's something about, sometimes I don't really like the feel of like laying into your drums super hard. Like I feel like it doesn't give the best acoustic sound. Yeah. I know that like sometimes it can, especially if you're trying to get loud dynamics, but other times it feels like it kind of like chokes it in a way or something.
Yeah, makes it sound boxy. Yeah.
Yeah. So the cool thing about the extremes is that they sit between a 5A and a 5B. And a lot of times I will pull out one pair of sticks and I'm like, okay, this definitely is like a 5A, and then I'll pull out another pair of sticks and they're like the same diameter, but the density is so much different that it feels like it's like a 5 or a 2B, and I'm just like, holy shit, this is like a solid wood stick.
And that's the thing, is it, sometimes you can get a 5A that feels like a 2B and you can get a 2B that feels like a 5A because of the density of the grains or whatever. I don't know how it works, but
Yeah, so it's that's like a good spot for me to sit in, because it's like, if it's a little too heavy, I can work with it. If it's a little too light, it sucks, but I can still work with it.
Yeah, yeah. Cool, man. Right, so these are the last three. These are music. These aren't drums, drum related. And these could be, again, polarizing, controversial.
Oh, I'm ready. I'm ready to disappoint everyone. Okay.
Right, so Slayer or Metallica?
Ooh, I'm going to have to say Slayer, just because I think they just write heavier shit all around. And yeah.
I think Rain and Blood, more consistent too. Dude, Rain and Blood. Exactly. I think more consistent. Again, that's a whole other podcast, that one question. But yeah, okay, cool. So Slayer. Right. European tour or US tour?
Ooh, I'm going to have to disappoint European people and say US tour, just because there's just so many, not luxuries, but there's just so many like perks or normal things that you take for granted. Yeah, comforts and just like, you know, stuff that makes life easier. Like, dude, I know that everybody laughs at us for having Walmart and being like,
dude, Walmart is what makes tour great in America.
It absolutely does, dude. Like, I'm sorry, but unless someone can tell me different, when I go to Europe, it's like, if I need a pair of socks and I need a headphone cable and I need, like, you know,
some juice.
Yeah, just like some fucking random shit, like some dog food. I don't know. But like, I could go to Walmart and I can literally get that and anything else I can think of in one place. And then in Europe, it's like, oh, it's 4:30. Yeah, everything's closed.
especially on a Sunday, being like an off day on a Sunday in mainland Europe. I mean, people won't know the pain unless they've been in that situation when you're on tour and it's a Sunday on an off day.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, nowhere is open for anything.
I know. It's like, well, I guess I'll just go drink for 10 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, there's just all those little things that, you know, you enjoy being in America. And I will say, though, that Europe, their hospitality is great. I love being able to have homemade meals all the time, and then of course, like, venues can be nicer, and just the attention and care that you get as an artist is so much greater being over in Europe than it is America. But man, I gotta say that, like, all those little things that I, you know, enjoy being over here, I miss it hell of a lot when I go over there.
The conveniences.
Conveniences. That's the fucking word that my brain could not figure out.
We got there.
We did.
Right. Okay. And this is the last one of this lot. Festival or club?
Ooh. I guess a festival, because over in Europe, again, it's like you can get paired on some festivals with some people that you would never expect in a million years to see. And then you have all that, like, you know, VIP access, like, depending on who it is, and you can rub elbows with them and stuff in the right scenarios. And so, yeah, I guess festival.
Yeah, man, I totally understand that. Like, we did, have you guys done Roskilde?
Yeah.
Festival in Denmark. Yeah. Oh, man. And we played, it was Stevie Wonder. And obviously, we played on like the tiniest, shittest stage and at the back that no one even knew existed. But like, but yeah, Stevie Wonder and Jack White, I think it was, on the main stage. And we just, you know, just had a load of drinks and went and watched Stevie Wonder and Jack White. And we were like, this is fucking crazy.
That's right. I actually tell people about that all the time. And that was, we were on that same day. And
That's right. But it's the biggest place in the world. And everything has its own separate backstages, right?
Yeah, and it was weird because we had a full headliner set that day, which, like, never happens. And then I think when you guys were playing, we might have been playing, or you guys were playing around the same time that Nails was playing, and I hadn't seen Nails yet. And so that I was like, sense. Well, I already did a tour with Carcass, so I got to go see these guys.
Exactly. You saw us a few times.
Yeah, just a few.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, man, I totally understand that the festival thing is like, and sometimes you get to play with like your favorite band and you never thought you'd play with your favorite, you know, like playing with Slayer or something or whatever. And it's like, oh shit, this is sick.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And Randy Blythe is like running around backstage or whatever. And you're like, I would never get to see you ordinarily.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly, like starstruck moments. Right, last little thing, and then I'll let you go because I've kept you for like 2 hours.
Yeah, no worries.
But right, so last thing, if you can do it, I like to do like a top three, top five thing, but I hate doing the kind of standard, who's your favorite drummers, blah, blah, blah. So this could be quite tricky. Top three Dahlia albums that you didn't play on.
Oh, man, I already got this figured out.
Oh, really? So, okay, cool.
Yeah, so number one is Unhallowed. Nice. That was the first one that I heard, and it was like the fucking heaviest, darkest riffs I had heard at that point. And it was like, I've always struggled since, and I don't know if anyone knows how to like define this or what bands to listen to or what, but like, it was always really dark, heavy sounding stuff without sounding blackened. You know?
Yeah.
I like black metal, but black metal has that dark sound. It's always like the minor sounding stuff. Whereas this is like, it's got a little bit different variation, and the melodies I don't feel are so, you know, characteristic or predictable, like according to that genre.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
But not only that, album is just fucking raw as hell. Like, it's not studio polished. Everything just sounds like pissed, just like aggro and pissed. And like, and because of that, it lends to the darkness. I fucking love it. The second album that I didn't play on would be Miasma, because that one also just has a lot of rawness to it. A lot of like really cool, heavy shit. And then, I would say Ritual after that, because that album, it like I felt had a really diverse sound to it. It had so many different ideas for songs and feels, and it went so many different places, and it was like, oh wow, this is awesome to hear, kind of like almost a variety album in a way, but it's still like the band playing to their strengths and writing really cool shit that we've never like completely heard before.
Yeah, it was kind of not a departure, but there was more kind of experimental, quote unquote, stuff that the band hadn't done till that point, it felt like.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just, you know, the minute that I heard On Stirring Seas of Salted Blood, it's just that mid-tempo feel, and it's just so fucking heavy with the melodies and the riffs and stuff, and I just was like, holy shit, this is so fucking killer to hear this from this band that just, you know, they've always kind of got some groovers and stuff, but this one really just like puts the seat back and just fucking, you know, rocks.
On the chopper, just like
exactly.
Yeah, sick, man. Well, yeah, that's everything, dude. That was good fun. Thank you so much for joining me for this very long time.
Yeah, man, of course. And dude, definitely I will do another episode in the future if you want, and really happy I got asked to do it.
All right, man, thank you so much, and we'll keep in touch and speak again soon.
All right, yeah, take care, man.
Rad, thanks, dude.